Words matter, don't they? Words are pretty important. You don't have to try to convince me, as many words as I end up using in a week, that words are important. But the uniform or applied use of word becomes a tricky topic when two people start to try to discuss, let's say, the rules of grammar or styles of writing. Whose textbook holds the most credence or was taught by which professor at which university? And suddenly words become a tricky topic. But it's not just true in English and grammar, is it? Words are a tricky topic in church, I think, too. We get kind of used to and stuck on our own sense of grammar, our own sense of jargon. We adopt words into our church cultures and we get used to them, we get comfortable with them, we get attached to them, and suddenly we get challenged when new words are introduced or when words are used in a way that we don't approve. Hope. It's a poor little one-syllable word that gets a bad reputation in pop Christianity, hope. Yet it is featured in some pretty important teachings within our Bible. Depending on who's counting, the word hope appears in the Bible 122 to 129 times, and nearly equally between the Old Testament and the New. But folks act like we're not supposed to even say this little word, like it's not good enough to get the job done. Yet there is hope right in the middle of Paul's big three from 1 Corinthians chapter 13. You remember he said, "So faith, hope, love abide these three, but the greatest of these is love." Faith, hope, love. Of course, he does declare love to be the greatest, and maybe that's where poor little hope slides off into obscurity. Christians have a habit that, oddly, I've not noticed anyone else doing, and I'm thankful that you all, as a congregational culture, are not generally prone to this. Please don't start doing it. That is, someone will use a word like hope. A perfectly mature adult, spiritually mature, competent, well-educated, and when they say the word hope, fully meaning it, the other person will edit them. "Oh, you mean believe, don't you?" Or they'll say, "Don't say hope, say trust." And to me, someone, by the way, like that is interrupting a perfectly competent adult sentence to edit, and being incredibly arrogant when doing so, but we see it happen. And you express your faith, and I express my faith, and sometimes we won't agree. But we don't have to edit each other mid-sentence, do we? You see, apparently poor little hope doesn't sound confident enough for some people, for these rude folks who like to edit. And pop Christianity is nothing if not confident. So this poor little word gets invalidated until surely, to borrow from Paul's lingo, it apparently becomes then the least of these. Yet it was good enough for some of the important folks of the Bible. Job in chapter 13 said, "Though he slay me, yet I will hope in him. I will surely defend my ways to his face." The psalmist in Psalm 39 wrote, "But now, Lord, what do I look for? My hope is in you." The 71st Psalm, "You are my hope, O Lord God. You are my confidence from my youth." The 130th Psalm, "I wait for the Lord. My soul does wait, and in his word I do hope." Paul wrote his letter to the Romans, and in chapter 15 lapsed into a benediction of sorts and says, "Now the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing." And finally, if you've hung with me through this volley of hope, the writer of Hebrews says, "We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and steadfast." Now, I know you get the point by now. But if a little's good, then a lot's really better where a sermon's concerned, right? And so we have all these mentions of hope and so many more. Our brand new hymnal there in the pew racks is in the back indexed by key theme. And one of those themes is hope. And there are 10 hymns in the hope section of this new hymnal. And you know some of them. In fact, you just sang the tune. The last hymn we sang was to the tune of a hymn called In the Bulb. It's listed as being one of those in the hope section. It's a new-ish hymn, and I like it. I've been singing it for years, and I hope you're going to come to enjoy that song. I find it promising. Also in the hope section, we find the song He Lives. Also the triumphant old song, Since Jesus Came Into My Heart, which I, by the way, dare you to try to sing without smiling. It can't be done. And this hope section is anchored, in my opinion, by the classic hymn, The Solid Rock. Those are hymns of hope. Well, Paul had a tough question put to him as he wrote this section of the First Thessalonian letter. Folks were asking an honest question. It came straight out of their pain. It was a sincere question, one born of a little confusion, because they were living in tough and scary times, and I can't blame them a lot. I would have asked things like this too. They had watched loved ones punished for the faith. Some had just been snatched up out of their homes and taken away. Maybe they'd been jailed. Maybe they'd been beaten, killed, and we certainly know that some had in fact been executed specifically because of the faith. The Roman oppression of the times was tightening up and making life awfully tough. People were wondering what was up ahead. They were also, though, weighing the costs of this faith. And among their questions they had put to Paul were a few versions that went like this. What about my friends? What about my loved ones? Will they live again? Will they be in heaven? Will we see them someday? And what you heard earlier that Nancy read, our text, was Paul's response in part. He said, starting in verse 13, "But we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about those who have died, so that you may not grieve as others who have no hope. For since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so, though through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have died." Now, those who love to get fascinated with the end of times and the letter of the law they think the Bible is spelling out about that tricky time have just now departed from us. I've lost them for the rest of the sermon. They've left the room in their minds, and if they stick around, they're going to be disappointed probably in the next few minutes. Because I'm not sure that's at all what Paul was really talking about, compared to the point he does seem to be making here. In these weeks of this sermon series entitled As People with Hope, we're searching for the source that loved ones might discover in the Scripture. We are looking for salve to put on aching hearts. I'm speaking to all of us, because all of us, if we live long enough, we'll have our tender hearts pierced by the death of a loved one. Many of you have already, some far too many times. And we all begin to wonder about God's provision, about what might have happened. And that's where people were at Thessalonica. It doesn't take an arrest and persecution for a loss to absolutely break our hearts. We are never ready, so I have heard grieving persons affirm, for far too many years now. Oh, our friends can tell us so many things trying to help. They'll say our loved ones are in a better place now. They'll say that their suffering is over now. They'll point out to us that they've lived a good, long life, but that doesn't fix everything. It doesn't salve the hurt inside us, and it especially doesn't add up when some of these things just aren't true. and it doesn't satisfy our curiosities either. Paul said at the end of this section, for us to take these words and comfort each other with them. And we have acknowledged that persecution seems to be the specific backdrop, as Paul wrote. But what is here might help us. What is here might comfort us. So in these verses, he served up perspective and summarized it as hope. Someone has said that hope is putting faith to work when doubting would be easier. Doubt really is the easier option to life's big uncertainties, isn't it? Doubt doesn't raise the new questions that hope does. Doubt doesn't risk anywhere near like hope either, does it? Doubt could become the default mode so easily, and for many who've lived a while, that's an understandable conclusion. It's harder to believe. Back in Atlanta, our church was located in the Buckhead community. That was inside the perimeter, and the neighborhood was affluent with beautiful old homes and landscaped yards just like parts of our city here. Movies and television shows and commercial crews liked to film in Buckhead and nearby Midtown. And I noticed just a few days ago, as a matter of fact, that a Christmas movie that they were filming in our subdivision as I was moving here is getting ready to release soon. I won't say the name of it because that would sound like an endorsement. And I don't think I will endorse that film. But it was filming in our neighborhood, and it was indicative of so much that happens around that area. More than once, I walked our campus and our church's buildings with film location managers as they photographed spaces that they might get to film in. They always swore you to secrecy when they did these tours, trying to find just the right space. They didn't want you to go home and tell anyone who you'd talked with or what movie was about to be filmed nearby. I can say now, though, that for instance, the second Hunger Games movie came within an eyelash. Some of y'all, your heads just went up just like that. Wow. I'll say it again, the second Hunger Games movie came within an eyelash of being filmed in parts of our church building back in Buckhead. And so the revenue that came from these kind of rents was always a welcome thing to our church treasurer and to our business administrator, as you might imagine. And more than our building, they were usually interested in our parking lot. The trailers and trucks that are required to film even a TV commercial, much less a show or a movie, are tremendous. And they need huge expanses of asphalt that are not being used a lot during the week. Churches fit the bill. And our administrator pointed out one time that these kinds of film projects always have babies. What he meant by that was that once a production crew discovered you and once they rented space from you, they usually came back when they were working on the next project in the neighborhood. They had babies, and so the trick was to work with them the first time and get on their radar screen. Well, hope might be so unpopular in Christianity, in part because hope always has babies. Hope carries some risk, some potential that we could be wrong and that it could hurt. Hope also requires us to occasionally wrestle with the sub-questions that come with it. We can choose to hope blindly, and we often do, but at other times we weigh the costs on the way to choosing hope and try our best to rationalize and test our memories of past times that surely shed light on this time. Hope feels vulnerable. And at times, life defies us to find any solid proof that we should venture out in that way. Our text today refers to the parousia, that is, the second coming or the return of Christ. And Paul does present the second coming with images that pop. This dramatic text that we had read today falls within the category of eschatology, the doctrine of the end of the world or the last things. Now, if you're just itching to get lost in the weeds, let me give you a fascinating note then. Scholars believe that Paul was convinced that this was going to happen in his lifetime. And if you read his letters, it's easy to see where they're coming from on that. There's an urgency and immediacy to his writing. But none of that is Paul's central intent. He uses that perspective in order to deal with the hurts and fears of scared and grieving people. And if you want to be specific, they were afraid that their loved ones who had died were going to miss out on the glory of Jesus at his coming and all that might take place once he did. They loved their friends and family. They missed their friends and family, and they needed some assurance that they hadn't just died for nothing. They were asking questions of meaning, questions a lot like the ones you ask and that I ask. In fact, Jennifer McBride says that this only gave Paul a chance to answer an even bigger question. What does the coming of the Lord mean for us who are alive today? She also points out that at roughly the same time, John at Patmos was writing his revelation and forecast this for the people, just like what Paul was saying to the Thessalonians, "Behold, I am making all things new," we hear in chapter 21. Paul tells the Thessalonian church in verse 14, "We believe that Christ died and rose again, and so do we today." Paul reassures them that their loved ones will participate fully in all that is to come. The Nicene Creed, which we recite on occasion or parts of, picked up on the need to declare this. In those ancient words we have shared, "He will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead, and his kingdom will have no end." But to be people of hope, to really be people of hope, we have to do one other risky thing. One other counterintuitive thing. We have to let go of history. Moltmann argues that history itself cannot produce anything astonishingly new. It can only proceed from the past and bring about what is possible, what we have seen. In contrast, the new thing that Revelation promises, that Paul speaks of, the coming Christ brings, is not based on what has come before or on what is possible. Rather, it is the Lord descending from heaven, resurrection from the dead, creation out of nothing, the genuinely new, the unexpected surprise. In other words, more than we could possibly ask or imagine from God. The coming Christ proposes to do a new thing. The advent of Christ brings the impossible, turns a rock into a pool of water, makes a way where there is no way. But with the heart of a pastor, Paul goes on this seemingly impossible journey of trying to explain what he's just said to them. Paul has begun this section saying, "I do not want you to grieve as those who are uninformed. So let me tell you why you should have hope." And then he goes to lay out a theological treatise that the church has struggled to understand for centuries ever since he wrote it. This side of heaven, this side of a fuller knowledge, life brings us moments where this sense of hope is really all we have to stand on. The only or last leg holding us up sometimes is our choice to doubt, our choice not to doubt, but to hope in things that are beyond us. You know, they say that there are no atheists in foxholes. Well, I have to wonder if there are truly any Christians in grief without hope. The tough part is we do have a choice. We can choose to doubt. We've got that freedom. But when we can find a way to tap into the power, to choose the hopeful path even in our deepest pain, We have a different set of resources to bring to bear on our grief. Suddenly there is a little more power and a little more strength to our wondering and to our waiting. That makes hope and joy cousins, you know. Joy is a more universally popular word with Christians. At Christmas time, we even make Christmas ornaments and art objects out of the word joy. We like those three words and we depict them and we hang them on our tree. We post them on our wall. Joy. Those ornaments made of that word. We even like to say the word joy. But hope and joy are cousins for one simple reason. They both have to be chosen. God isn't going to knock any of us over the head and force us to have these, joy or hope. We get to decide for ourselves. My prayer is that when my time comes, as it has and will again, when your time comes, as it has and will again, we'll reach into our resources and choose the hopeful path. The one that we can't always explain and that feels a little risky sometimes, but that keeps us walking with God long enough for God to have a chance to show us why we might have chosen wisely. We stand just now and sing a hymn of response. It's listed in your order of worship. You might be filtering your own life reality through your sense of discouragement or through your sense of hope. You might be journeying with this congregation and be glad to be back with it or glad to be newly among us. And you may have a decision that you're ready to announce. You may have been journeying with the possibility of this faith and may have decided that life through Christ's salvation has begun to make some sense for you, even with all of its mystery. Whatever your decision may be, we all stand just now, sing a hymn of response. I'll be down here at the front. Stand as you're able. Let's join our voices.